Chapter 2 was bowed to that degree which almost reproaches a feeling observer for standing upright. The arrival of the soldiery had drawn him out from his drop of drink at the Duke of York as it had attracted Anne. At her call he crossed the mill bridge and came towards the window. Anne inquired of him what it all meant, but Simon Burden, without answering, continued to move on with parted gums, staring at the cavalry on his own private account with a concern that people often show about temporal phenomena when such matters can affect them but a short time longer. "You'll walk into the mill pond," apostrophe said Anne. "What are they doing?" "You were a soldier many years ago, and ought to know." Apostrophe apostrophe, "Don't ask me, Mrs. Anne," apostrophe said the military relic, depositing his body against the wall one limb at a time. "I were only in the foot, ye know, and never had a clear understanding of horses. Eh, I be a old man, and of no judgment now." Apostrophe apostrophe, some additional pressure, however, caused him to search further in his worm-eaten magazine of ideas, and he found that he did know in a dim irresponsible way. The soldiers must have come there to camp. Those men they had seen first were the markers. They had come on before the rest to measure out the ground. He who had accompanied them was the quartermaster. "And so you see they have got all the lines marked out by the time the regiment have come up," apostrophe he added. "And then they will well a dearie. Who'd ha supposed that over Combe would see such a day as this?" Apostrophe apostrophe, "And then they will apostrophe, then ah, it's gone from me again." Apostrophe apostrophe said Simon. "Oh, and then they will raise their tents, you know, and picket their horses." That was it. So it was. Apostrophe apostrophe, by this time the column of horse had ascended into full view, and they formed a lively spectacle as they rode along the high ground in marching order, backed by the pale blue sky, and lit by the southerly sun. Their uniform was bright and attractive. White buckskin pantaloons, three-quarter boots, scarlet shakos set off with lace, mustachios waxed to a needle point, and above all, those richly ornamented blue jackets mantled with the historic pelis, that fascination to women, and encumbrance to the wearers themselves. "'Tis the York hussars," apostrophe apostrophe said Simon Burden, brightening like a dying ember fan. "Foreigners to a man, and enrolled long since my time. But as good hearty comrades, they say, as you'll find in the king's service." Apostrophe apostrophe, "Here are more and different ones," apostrophe said Mrs. Garland. Other troops had, during the last few minutes, been ascending the down at a remoter point, and now drew near. These were of different weight and build from the others, lighter men, in helmet hats, with white plumes. "I don't know which I like best," apostrophe said Anne. "These, I think, after all." Apostrophe apostrophe, Simon, who had been looking hard at the latter, now said that they were the TH Dragoons. "All Englishmen they," apostrophe said the old man. "They lay at Budmouth Barracks a few years ago." Apostrophe apostrophe, "They did. I remember it," apostrophe said Mrs. Garland. "And lots of the chaps about here listed at the time," apostrophe said Simon. "I can call to mind that there was ah, 'tis gone from me again. However, all that's of little account now." Apostrophe apostrophe, the dragoons passed in front of the lookers-on as the others had done, and their gay plumes, which had hung lazily during the ascent, swung to northward as they reached the top, showing that on the summit a fresh breeze blew. "But look across there," apostrophe said Anne. There had entered upon the down from another direction several battalions of foot, in white kerseymere breeches and cloth gaiters. They seemed to be weary from a long march, the original black of their gaiters and boots being whitey-brown with dust. Presently came regimental wagons, and the private canteen carts which followed at the end of a convoy. The space in front of the mill pond was now occupied by nearly all the inhabitants of the village, who had turned out in alarm, and remained for pleasure, their eyes lighted up with interest in what they saw. For trappings and regimentals, war horses and men, in towns and attraction, were here almost a sublimity. The troops filed to their lines, dismounted, and in quick time took off their accoutrements, rolled up their sheepskins, picketed and unbitted their horses, and made ready to erect the tents, as soon as they could be taken from the wagons and brought forward. When this was done, at a given signal the canvases flew up from the sod, and thenceforth every man had a place in which to lay his head. Though nobody seemed to be looking on, but the few at the window, and in the village street, there were, as a matter of fact, many eyes converging upon that military arrival in its high and conspicuous position, not to mention the glances of birds and other wild creatures. Men in distant gardens, women in orchards, and at cottage doors, shepherds on remote hills, turnipers in blue-green enclosures miles away, captains with spy glasses out at sea, were regarding the picture keenly. Those 3 or 4 thousand men of one machine-like movement, some of them swashbucklers by nature, others, doubtless, of a quiet shopkeeping disposition who had inadvertently got into uniform, all of them had arrived from nobody knew where, and hence were matter of great curiosity. They seemed to the mere eye to belong to a different order of beings from those who inhabited the valleys below. Apparently unconscious and careless of what all the world was doing elsewhere, they remained picturesquely engrossed in the business of making themselves a habitation on the isolated spot which they had chosen. Mrs. Garland was of a festive and sanguine turn of mind, a woman soon set up and soon set down, and the coming of the regiments quite excited her. She thought there was reason for putting on her best cap, thought that perhaps there was not, that she would hurry on the dinner, and go out in the afternoon, then that she would, after all, do nothing unusual, nor show any silly excitements whatever, since they were unbecoming in a mother and a widow. Thus circumscribing her intentions till she was toned down to an ordinary person of 40, Mrs. Garland accompanied her daughter downstairs to dine, saying, "Presently we will call on Miller Loveday, and hear what he thinks of it all." (2) Somebody knocks and comes in. Miller Loveday was the representative of an ancient family of corn grinders whose history is lost in the mists of antiquity. His ancestral line was contemporaneous with that of De Rose, Howard, and De La Zouch, but, owing to some trifling deficiency in the possessions of the House of Loveday, the individual names and intermarriages of its members were not recorded during the Middle Ages, and thus their private lives in any given century were uncertain. But it was known that the family had formed matrimonial alliances with farmers, not so very small, and once with a gentleman tanner, who had for many years purchased after their death the horses of the most aristocratic persons in the county Fiery Steeds, that earlier in their career had been valued at many hundred guineas. It was also ascertained that Mr. Loveday's great-grandparents had been 8 in number, and his great-great-grandparents 16, every one of whom reached 2 years of discretion. At every stage backwards his sires and gammers thus doubled and doubled till they became a vast body of Gothic ladies and gentlemen of the rank known as earls or villeins, full of importance to the country at large, and ramifying throughout the unwritten history of England. His immediate father had greatly improved the value of their residence by building a new chimney and setting up an additional pair of millstones. Overcombe Mill presented at one end the appearance of a hard-worked house slipping into the river, and at the other of an idle, genteel place, half cloaked with creepers at this time of the year, and having no visible connection with flour. It had hips instead of gables, giving it a round-shouldered look, 4 chimneys with no smoke coming out of them, two zigzag cracks in the wall, several open windows, with a looking glass here and there inside, showing its warped back to the passerby, snowy dimity curtains waving in the draft, two mill doors, one above the other, the upper enabling a person to step out upon nothing at a height of 10 feet from the ground, a gaping arch vomiting the river, and a lean, long-nosed fellow looking out from the mill doorway, who was the hired grinder, except when a bulging 15-stone man occupied the same place, namely, the miller himself. Behind the mill door, and invisible to the mere wayfarer who did not visit the family, were chalked addition and subtraction sums, many of them originally done wrong, and the figures half rubbed out and corrected, nuts being turned into nines, and ones into twos. These were the miller's private calculations. There were also chalked in the same place rows and rows of strokes like open palings, representing the calculations of the grinder, who in his youthful ciphering studies had not gone so far as Arabic figures. In the court in front were two worn-out millstones, made useful again by being let in level with the ground. Here people stood to smoke and consider things in muddy weather, and cats slept on the clean surfaces when it was hot. In the large stubborn tree at the corner of the garden, was erected a pole of larch fir, which the miller had bought with others at a sale of small timber in Damer's Wood one Christmas week. It rose from the upper boughs of the tree to about the height of a fisherman's mast, and on the top, was a vane in the form of a sailor with his arm stretched out. When the sun shone upon this figure it could be seen that the greater part of his countenance was gone, and the paint washed from his body so far as to reveal that he had been a soldier in red before he became a sailor in blue. The image had, in fact, been John, one of our coming characters, and was then turned into Robert, another of them. This revolving piece of statuary could not, however, be relied on as a vane, owing to the neighboring hill, which formed variable currents in the wind. The leafy and quieter wing of the mill house was the part occupied by Mrs. Garland and her daughter, who made up in summer time for the narrowness of their quarters, by overflowing into the garden on stools and chairs. The parlor or dining room had a stone floor, a fact which the widow sought to disguise by double carpeting, lest the standing of Anne and herself should be lowered in the public eye. Here now the midday meal went lightly and mincingly on, as it does where there is no greedy carnivorous man to keep the dishes about, and was hanging on the close, when somebody entered the passage as far as the chink of the parlor door, and tapped. This proceeding was probably adopted to kindly avoid giving trouble to Susan, the neighbor's pink daughter, who helped at Mrs. Garland's in the mornings, but was at that moment particularly occupied in standing on the water butt and gazing at the soldiers, with an inhaling position of the mouth and circular eyes. There was a flutter in the little dining room the sensitiveness of habitual solitude makes hearts beat for preternaturally small reasons and a guessing as to who the visitor might be. It was some military gentleman from the camp perhaps? No, that was impossible. It was the parson? No, he would not come at dinner time. It was the well-informed man who traveled with drapery and the best Birmingham earrings? Not at all. His time was not till Thursday at 3. Before they could think further the visitor moved forward another step, and the diners got a glimpse of him through the same friendly chink that had afforded him a view of the Garland dinner table. Oh! It is only Loveday. Apostrophe, this approximation to nobody, was the miller above mentioned, a hale man of 55 or 60 hale all through, as many were in those days, and not merely veneered with purple by exhilarating victuals and drinks, though the latter were not at all despised by him. His face was indeed rather pale than otherwise, for he had just come from the mill. It was capable of immense changes of expression. Mobility was its essence, a roll of flesh forming a buttress to his nose on each side, and a deep ravine lying between his lower lip and the tumulus represented by his chin. These fleshy lumps moved stealthily, as if of their own accord, whenever his fancy was tickled. his eyes having lighted on the tablecloth, plates, and viands, he found himself in a position which had a sensible awkwardness for a modest man who always liked to enter only at seasonable times the presence of a girl of such pleasantly soft ways as Anne Garland, she who could make apples seem like peaches, and throw over her shillings the glamour of guineas when she paid him for flour. "Dinner is over, neighbor Loveday, please come in," said the widow, seeing his case. The miller said something about coming in presently, but Anne pressed him to stay, with a tender motion of her lip as it played on the verge of a solicitous smile without quite lapsing into one her habitual manner when speaking. Loveday took off his low-crowned hat and advanced. He had not come about pigs or fowls this time. "You have been looking out, like the rest of us, no doubt, Mrs. Garland, at the mampus of soldiers that have come upon the down? Well, one of the horse regiments is the TH Dragoons, my son John's regiment, you know." The announcement, though it interested them, did not create such an effect as the father of John had seemed to anticipate. But Anne, who liked to say pleasant things, replied, "The dragoons look nicer than the foot, or the German cavalry either. They are a handsome body of men," said the miller in a disinterested voice. "Faith, I didn't know they were coming, though it may be in the newspaper all the time. But old Dairyman keeps it so long, that we never know things till they be in everybody's mouth." This dairyman was a squireen living near, who was chiefly distinguished in the present warlike time by having a nephew in the yeomanry. "We were told that the yeomanry went along the turnpike road yesterday," said Anne, "and they say that they were a pretty sight, and quite soldierly." "Well, they be not regulars," said Miller Loveday, keeping back harsher criticism as uncalled for. But inflamed by the arrival of the dragoons, which had been the exciting cause of his call, his mind would not go to yeomanry. "John has not been home these 5 years," he said. "And what rank does he hold now?" said the widow. "He's trumpet major, ma'am, and a good musician." The miller, who was a good father, went on to explain that John had seen some service too. He had enlisted when the regiment was lying in this neighborhood, more than 11 years before, which put his father out of temper with him, as he had wished him to follow on at the mill. But as the lad had enlisted seriously, and as he had often said that he would be a soldier, the miller had thought that he would let Jack take his chance in the profession of his choice. Loveday had 2 sons, and the second was now brought into the conversation by a remark of Anne's, that neither of them seemed to care for the miller's business. "No," said Loveday in a less buoyant tone. "Robert, you see, must needs go to sea." "He is much younger than his brother?" said Mrs. Garland. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.